Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. On our way into our conversation with Sahar Aziz, I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Numbers 1-800-638-7781. If you're a first or second time home buyer looking for a home in the city of Baltimore, wherever you live now, call that number 1-800-638-7781, and there may be a home for you. Also remind you as we get into our conversation that WEAA invites you to the opening reception of the Sam Wallace Jamaican Folk Art Pottery and Modern Technique this Saturday, April 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. here at our WEAA studios. There'll be a gallery talk at 5 p.m. Beverly Carter and Lewis Hudnell are the curators. The exhibition runs to the end of May. More information is available at 443-885-3564 or WEAA.org. It's sponsored in part by DMV REI United. We are about to have a conversation with Sahar Aziz. She's an associate professor at the Texas Wesleyan School of Law, where she teaches national security and civil rights. She's a fellow of the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, author of Caught in a Preventative Paradigm, Selective Counterterrorism in Post-9/11 America. And you can follow her on Twitter at Sahar Aziz Law. That's S-A-H-A-R-A-Z-I-Z Law. And we're going to talk about Tarek Mahana. And welcome, Sahar. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And the lines are open at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump onto our Facebook pages and make a comment there as well. This started out for me when I read the story by Chris Hedges, who was on the show not long ago. First they came for the Muslims, and then there was a piece this Sunday in the New York Times written by Andrew March, who testified at this trial. We're going to talk about A Dangerous Mind. And he's a little radio shy, didn't want to come on the air. He said there's some great people out there, and the great people he talked about was Sahar Aziz, who wrote a piece for the Christian Science Monitor, Tarek Mahana, Punishing Muslims for Free Speech Only Helps Al-Qaeda. And we need to bring this case to your attention because it's pretty stunning. Sahar, let's just start with what happened here. And I think my guess is, unless you read some things online, like Truthdig and other places like that, or if you don't look at the Christian Science Monitor online, if you don't read the New York Times, you never heard of this.
Right. Well, this case is highly problematic because it's really important first free speech case that puts the Constitution on trial. It's not so much about Tarek Mahana, but it's more about how he has been convicted and sentenced to 17 and a half years for what is essentially pure speech. And if this sets a precedent, then anyone who has very controversial or political ideas and expresses them could be subject to imprisonment, which was precisely what the First Amendment is aimed to prevent. So just to give you a brief background on the facts, Tarek Mahana, I believe he's 29 now, but starting probably in the early 2000s, if not 1990s, he was under surveillance by the FBI, and he took a trip to Yemen in 2004 with two other people. One of them ended up serving as an informant and made a deal with law enforcement. And so Mahana claims he went to Yemen for 2 weeks in search of an Islamic school and to learn Islam and learn Arabic. And he came back and he continued his graduate studies in pharmacology. The government claims, no, you went there to receive training to engage in terrorist acts, and you were also looking to go to Iraq. Ultimately, the person that he went with two people, and one of them did continue on to Iraq. Mahana claims he had nothing to do with that, and whatever that person did was not, he didn't have anything to do with it. And then when he came back, he started to post translations of readily available materials, and some of them are, I guess, what you would call bona fide jihadi, pro self-defense against the United States policy. But these documents are available online. You can get them now. I think one of them is called 39 Ways to Perform Jihad, something along those lines. And he translated them from Arabic to English, and he uploaded them. And he worked with, or he appeared to have worked with, Tibian Publications. And the government suspected that Tibian Publications was somehow associated with Al-Qaeda. So they used his otherwise speech activities to claim that he provided material support to terrorists and therefore was sentenced to 17 and a half years. And just to kind of give you an idea of what kind of activities we're talking about. So watching jihadi videos with his friends, lending compact discs to people, presumably with controversial material on it, but nothing that's illegal. It's not banned. He discussed with his friends their view of suicide bombings and killings of civilians, and he claims he does not support killing civilians, at least in his sentencing statement. He stated so. He translated texts that are and remain freely available on the Internet. He searched for information online about the 9/11 hijackers, and he asked a friend on how to hide his identity on materials that he uploaded. So all of these things are pure speech, and we have to put aside the controversial nature of it because ultimately it's very easy to get emotional about the fact that this is very offensive and controversial. It's more about should people have the right to engage in political dissent that is very offensive, that is extremist, so long as they do not incite lawlessness. And that's the Brandenburg test that the Supreme Court issued in 1969. But as long as it doesn't support imminent lawlessness, it's technically protected by the First Amendment. So that's kind of the heart of the case, and that's where many attorneys, particularly First Amendment attorneys, are very concerned that this could set a very bad precedent, because as you know, there are many, many groups and many individuals in the United States who have very controversial views, very unpopular and even offensive. I mean, some would say that about the Tea Party. But if we put all of them in jail, then we're going to have a very different society.
I think, folks, you can join us when you'd like at 410-319-8888. The reason I was so blown away by this, and I read quickly Chris Hedges' piece last week. First it came from the Muslims, but then I was really struck by Andrew March's piece, who testified at the trial. Because he's also an expert in Islam and in Middle Eastern politics. And he wrote that many of the things that Tarek Mahana wrote and put on his website and translated were things that came out of the Quran. These were not things that were texts written by al-Qaeda. And he even distanced himself by attacking al-Qaeda for attacking innocent civilians and refusing when they tried to set him up. With people coming in, informants and people working with the federal government, trying to set him up to kind of work with jihadists. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. I mean, he's a guy who said no to taking an active part in any violence, but just speaking his mind and working and thinking what he believed. That right. This, to me, is the most frightening thing about this case.
Right. And it's part of a even bigger problem, which I talk about in the piece that you cited, is what's happening is many young Muslim men are under surveillance, particularly those that have any kind of political dissent or any orthodox religious practices or views. And so the government will go and usually approach them with the request for a voluntary interview, some of them trying to be good Samaritans, thinking they have nothing to hide because they think just because I dissent with my government doesn't mean that I'm going to go to jail. They talk to them. Usually the government asks questions in such a way that it sets them up for a lie, and it's usually a lie that has nothing to do with terrorism. And then they come back to them and say, we're going to prosecute you for a false statement. And you can, 18 U.S.C. 1001 is a statute that makes anyone who lies to a federal agent, makes a material omission or makes a material false statement, subjected to up to five years imprisonment. So they tell them, look, we're going to prosecute you for this because we caught you in this lie, even though the lie has nothing to do with terrorism, or you can serve as an informant. And what Tarek Mahana claims, at least he stated in his sentencing statement, was that in 2004 he was approached by someone and he refused, and he said, and they told him, we're going to make your life hell. And since then, they've essentially made his life hell and ultimately put him away for 17 and a half years. So there's a much broader, this is part of a much broader counterterrorism strategy that is very aggressive and that conflates religious orthodoxy and political dissent with violent terrorism and unlawful activity, which ultimately chills any kind of free speech, particularly in Muslim communities. And then it's now spreading to anti-government groups, anti-environmental rights groups, animal rights groups. We saw some of it come out in Occupy Wall Street and how law enforcement was responding to them and the surveillance and infiltration. So it's starting out with the Muslims and it's spreading. And the reason why I think they're focusing on the Muslims is because they're a vulnerable, unpopular group. It's very easy to get juries to be disgusted by listening to the extremist rhetoric and forget that they should be focused on the principles of the First Amendment as opposed to some subjective decision as to, well, I agree with you or I don't agree with you. And then once you set that precedent, you can then move on to other groups. So it's a slippery slope.
It is, and it's slippery slope. And let me just get your thought on this and the thoughts on this. I was reading the article and I was thinking about, we had discussion with folks on both sides of this issue. One of the things that would come up is that, you know, while many of us loathe the idea and are opposed to the idea that the FBI, New York City Police, other organizations have infiltrated mosques and start spying on mosques and on Muslim Americans who are in this country, Muslim citizens of the United States of America, and that should not be allowed. On the other hand, the United States, I think, probably should have some leeway. Let's say just even with Tariq Mehana, when somebody supports a jihad, supports what was going on in some of the struggles in the Middle East, has been to Yemen and back, they might have a right to at times follow him, see what's going on, if he is connected to anything, but not to put him in jail for what he writes and thinks.
Right, and I think that's an important distinction you're making, which is called individualized suspicion or some kind of predicate act. So there's a very big difference between what Tariq Mehana's case involved and what the NYPD was doing. The NYPD, for those listeners who don't know, has been engaged perhaps for more than a year, if not a couple years, in blanket surveillance and fishing expeditions way beyond their jurisdiction. So they've been going to the University of Pennsylvania, to Yale University, to Rutgers, all over the East Coast, and spying on Muslim student associations, so infiltrating them and sending informants, and without any evidence that there is any wrongful activity. They actually don't even have evidence of dissent, which even if they did, that is not sufficient. That's completely an affront to the First Amendment, but they don't even have that. They're just fishing. They're essentially making the decision that if one or two Muslims have committed terrorism, whether it's the 9/11 hijackers or others after, or people abroad, then that warrants collective suspicion and surveillance of entire, you know, millions of people. And it doesn't matter whether these people go to Yale or University of Pennsylvania. It doesn't matter where they are, whether they're students or whether they're just going to pray. And we're going to be watching every move. The problem with that is, well, there's many problems, but from a legal perspective, from a First Amendment perspective, is this is the first step to having people convicted of thought crime, which is exactly what the Founding Fathers did not want. It has to start with the surveillance and the chilling effect, then people start self-censoring. And then people look behind their shoulders all the time, and then they're scared to say anything that's on their mind, and it turns into Saddam Hussein's Iraq. I mean, that's exactly what Iraq was like, and I have friends who lived under his brutal regime. And when you sense that just having some controversial belief could land you in jail, you are going to be living a very different life that's much worse. And so that's why I think we all have to be very vigilant about these types of issues, regardless whether we belong to a particular community or not, because it really is just a matter of time once it gets normalized that it affects everybody else.
I mean, one of the things that Chris Hedges wrote in his piece, First They Come for the Muslims, was that this is not an isolated case. I mean, that Muslim Americans from all over America have been followed, and some arrested, some put on trial for giving money to charities that we say are terrorists and put in prison. I mean, this is not, this might be, in some senses, the most egregious case, but not the only one that's going on.
Right. I actually wrote a piece called Countering Religion or Terrorism, and it talks about, it's on ICPU's website, ICPU.org, and it talks about the prosecution of charities and what I call the collateral prosecution of donors. So essentially, after 9/11, three of the largest Muslim charities were shut down within 3 months. And these were the United Ways for these communities. And they used to send humanitarian aid to conflict zones where there were a Muslim majority, such as Bosnia, Kashmir, Gaza, anywhere where people were in need. Because that was the whole point of humanitarian aid, was to give it to people who were civilians who were in war-torn areas. and they got shut down unilaterally, and all of their officers were prosecuted for material support to terrorism. And the prosecutor, the officers claimed that they had no intent to support terrorism. They were simply giving to hospitals and schools and medical clinics in these areas and food to these to civilians. And because the statute doesn't require specific intent, they were able to be convicted just by the mere fact that they knew that there was a designated terrorist organization operating in that particular area. So, for example, in Gaza or in Kashmir, if you have a group that is designated as terrorist and it's operating in that area, which is usually the case because that's why there's a conflict, then as long as you know they were designated, that can be a basis for prosecuting you, even though you will they cannot prove you intended to support them. They will tell you, yes, we know you meant to go and help poor children. It doesn't matter. We don't have to prove that you intended to support terrorism. Just the fact that you freed up funds, perhaps they could have spent on weapons, then, and without having to prove that you in fact did free up funds of terrorist groups, then you can go to jail. So the laws, unfortunately, after 9/11 have just become worse, in my view, in terms of protecting individual rights, and has just made it very easy for the government to select people based on their political beliefs.
Folks, just think about this for a moment and think about whether or not what you think about what's going on here, and whether some of you may really agree that people who are Muslim, who people like Tariq Mahan and others, should be prosecuted if they write things that are pro-jihadist, if they write things that are against the U.S. government. And many of you may be very worried about this, but I'd like to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888. I'm going to read you something that kind of inspired the article by Chris Hedges that I talked about, First They Come for the Muslims. And it comes from a text that was written in Germany before World War II. And he wrote this in the 1930s. And it's a play on that, but it fits where we are now when we think about going after hundreds of Muslims in America now, many of whom are innocent of anything. All they're doing is speaking their mind and living their life as U.S. citizens. And this, what originally was written was this by Martin Niemöller, who is a German pastor, a theologian who was an anti-communist who also fought against and supported Hitler in the beginning, then turned against Hitler because what he saw what he was doing to their country. And he wrote, "First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me." And that, in some ways, is what we're that's the danger, that as we become fearful in America of Muslims, of the Arab world, of people who of terrorism, quote unquote, that we allow these kind of rules to take over, that we don't see slipping in. I mean, nobody sees it slipping in. Few people pay attention to it. But these are the kind of things that come into a society that make it impossible for somebody for a democracy to survive. I mean, it comes down to a place, or it could come down to a place, Sahar, where people like you, for speaking out and defending people like Tariq Mahan, or people like me, who give people like that for a voice on the radio, could be in danger.
Right. Well, and I'll tell you, it has affected other communities, because I think that's part of the false sense of security that a lot of Americans have. So, for example, before 2001, the Congress was very close, literally on the verge of passing the End Racial Profiling Act. And the End Racial Profiling Act was a federal act that had been in the works for nearly 15 years, primarily by African-American civil rights leaders, as a result of just pernicious and aggressive profiling as part of the war on drugs against African-American males. And it was part of the en masse incarceration, which a great book to read about that is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow.
Yes.
Anyway, so it was very close to being passed, and then 9/11 shattered, it killed the bill. And for the last 12 years, they've been trying to pass it again because profiling affects the African-American community, as we saw with Trayvon Martin, which is a private act of profiling. But it affects the African-American community significantly, and it's a real problem vis-a-vis law enforcement. So national security and terrorism hysteria, or kind of this exaggeration of a threat and the fear-mongering that is produced by a government has essentially stalled something that will benefit millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. I mean, profiling happens against Latinos, it happens against Arabs, Muslims, African-Americans, Asians, based on different stereotypes. So that's one way that it has affected. Another way is the Occupy Wall Street movement. Many of the laws that were passed in the Patriot Act gave the government much more power to engage in surveillance and to infiltrate groups. And, for example, the Department of Justice changed its investigative guidelines in 2008 to make it essentially very easy for agents to infiltrate groups with any proof of illegal activity. Just a hunch could be the basis for what they call a threat assessment. And that's what they've been doing in infiltrating the anti-war groups. And people are not connecting the dot that the same authorities that are giving them the right to do that were all passed under the guise of protecting us from those Muslims. So, and the same thing also happens in immigration law. So there is definitely a relationship between all of these different areas. I mean, these different communities were more adversely impacted than other communities. So I say you're absolutely right in citing that statement from the 1960s. But unfortunately, I feel Americans are not making the connection, and what they're doing is saying, oh, you're defending Tariq Mahana. And I'm not here to defend Tariq Mahana. I don't know him, and I don't know, wasn't on the case. It's about the principles of the First Amendment. Because I personally don't agree with Tariq Mahana. I do find his views to be extremist.
Yep.
I don't agree with him politically. But if I don't, or if we don't allow people who disagree with us to express their views without having to go to jail, then it's just a matter of time before we end up going to jail because we express something no one else likes. We've got to have that to do that, so long as we don't direct or create imminent lawless activity. That's the standard. It has to be imminent lawless activity. Otherwise, you know, political hyperbole, that is not a true threat. That is not illegal.
And just to reiterate, before I reach to a piece that was in your article that I thought was really very powerful and interesting, which we'll get to in a minute, when it comes to Tariq Mahana, who was an American citizen, a Bostonian, was he born in the United States?
Yes, I believe, based on public records.
I think he was as well. And he was a pharmacist. Folks, I just want to reiterate here that Tariq Mahana, when he was convicted and put in jail for 17 and a half years, is not because that he was shown to have been trained in Yemen when he went to visit there. There's no proof or shown that existed anywhere. It's not that he gave material support. It's not that he didn't put any money into jihadist groups. He didn't do any of those things. He advocated for jihadist cause from the comfort of his home and his workplace. He was literally put in jail for speech crimes. There's nothing they could show he did, as it points out in this article. Now, let me just read this, because folks, you need to understand the seriousness of this. I think that the government indicting him for watching jihadist videos and to create a like mindset of people around those issues, discussing the religious justification for it as a Muslim, translating and authoring texts and videos around this issue, spoke of his admiration and love for Osama bin Laden, and this is why he was prosecuted, put in jail for 17 and a half years. I mean, it is mind-boggling to me, and I think that one of the things that you write about, Sahara, in your piece, and I didn't think about this till I read your piece, was how this parallels what happens in the, for want of a better term, the white extremist world, the hate world, the world of the Ku Klux Klan and Nazis and others. Talk a bit about that, your what you wrote there.
Right. So I think that I use those examples because I think most Americans can understand the free speech implications that, for example, with Ku Klux Klan and the Sovereign Citizens Movement and many white militias that have gone from 149 groups in 2008 when Obama was elected to over 1,200 groups now, these militia, what they call patriot groups, that are, most of them are based on white supremacist or some kind of very extreme ideology. And, you know, they're in operation, and they're not getting put in jail so long as they don't direct or incite imminent lawlessness. And I think most Americans can understand that because we can step back and say, I don't agree with them. I don't agree with the Ku Klux Klan. They're obviously very racist, very offensive. They're completely an affront to everything I believe in as a civil rights advocate. But I, as someone who believes in the First Amendment, I have to allow the space for even those types of views to be in the marketplace of ideas, and then hope that when I speak against them based on the merits, or when others, that reasonable people will come to my view, and there will be no coercion, and I'm not going to harass them or retaliate against them or put them in jail. I will certainly criticize them, and you know, I'm sure they would criticize me. And so it's about having that space to do that. So the irony or the contradiction, and this is where I think it exposes the government, in my opinion, racialization of Muslims, for lack of a better term, or maybe the better term is profiling, is that they are not treating these groups equally. They're going after Muslim dissidents in a way that is highly problematic because of the First Amendment implications, yet when it comes to treating these other groups who I think are equally virulent, equally offensive, they are abiding by the First Amendment. So we need to think of, we need to decide what kind of society do we want to live in, and are we going to make an exception, literally a constitutional exception, for certain races and certain minorities, which harkens back to America's, you know, worst days when we were treating people unequal before the law. So so I think it's a good way to look at it, is why do we allow those groups to operate, yet we want to shut down anyone who has a jihadi viewpoint. And equally, I think they're both offensive. I mean, I don't agree with neither of them. But again, it goes back to the idiom, if you let them go for everyone else, they're going to come after you eventually.
So what happens to his case from here, do you know?
Well, it will be appealed, and I'm sure that the First Amendment, there will be a First Amendment claim on appeal. And he's obviously going to be in jail unless it's reversed on appeal. So I'm not involved in the litigation of the case, but sure it will. I'm seeing evidence that they will be appealing it. But we'll see what the. I believe it's in the First Circuit.
And part of this was based on, if I read the article correctly, one of the articles correctly, a Supreme Court decision, a Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. What is that?
Yeah, so that's another highly problematic case. So this was issued in 2010, and this involved, this was a civil suit, and it involved some American nonprofit organizations who, by the way, were not Muslim, and one of them was a federal magistrate judge or federal administrative judge, and they had an organization called Humanitarian Law Project, and what they did is they purposely reached out to groups, primarily insurgent groups. Some of them were designated as terrorists by our government, and some were not, and tried to train them on how to use nonviolence to address their grievances, because many of these groups claim to have been victims of some kind of human rights violations by the government, or you know, they claim to have legitimate grievances. Some of them will be minorities, tribal minorities in a particular country, such as the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. So this went and said, we're going to teach you to go through the UN. We're going to teach you to go through the International Criminal Tribunal. Put down your guns and pick up your pens and use nonviolence as a way to resolve your disputes. And this is something that America, I think American values support in the abstract. And I think that you hear Secretary Clinton and many other secretaries of state say that more than often, of we support nonviolent conflict resolution. Well, two of the groups they wanted to help was the PKK, which is essentially the Kurdish nationalist group, which is designated as terrorist, and the Tamil Tigers, which is also designated as terrorist. And the government said, and they went and filed what you call kind of a preemptive suit to say, would you please assure us you will not prosecute us for material support, because we have no intent to support their violence. We're trying to do the opposite. And ultimately went through the courts and was a very long case, and the Supreme Court said, nope, sorry, that's illegal material support to terrorism, because any kind of coordinated advocacy with a designated group is unlawful for two reasons. One, lend it legitimacy by helping them to use a legitimate nonviolent means, you legitimate their violence, which I find to be a very flawed and irrational, illogical argument. But that was the argument that, that won the day, and Breyer, Justice Breyer, issued a scathing dissent, which I think was the right position. And then the other reason was that, you know, you could see, again, kind of the fungibility of resources, where as you help them do these things, you preserve their resources so that they can engage in violence. And so now, so the ruling stated that any coordinated advocacy with a designated group is unlawful material support. However, any independent advocacy is protected by the First Amendment. And so that was an issue in the case because Tibian Publications, which is, I think, operates this website where Mahana was uploading and translating the materials.
Right.
That was suspected by the government of having some kind of relationship with Al-Qaeda. It wasn't that they were Al-Qaeda. They just had someone, some in that company had some association. It was very tenuous. And because he was directly communicating with Tibian Publications, they alleged, well, therefore, you are now engaged in coordinated advocacy. And as you can see, that's very problematic because the Supreme Court did not say that. The Supreme Court said if you coordinate with a designated group. But that's why that decision was a very bad decision, because the government is going to try to stretch the definition of coordinated. You know, it could go up to 6 degrees of separation. I mean, what is the – how far can you go? And so then you really don't have a distinction between independent advocacy and coordinated advocacy. And then you do have a real risk that lawyers who file amicus briefs or lawyers who write op-eds, like Andrew March, is he going to be prosecuted because he wrote that op-ed and that could be perceived as somehow being coordinated with a terrorist group? I mean, maybe it's very broad and it's very expansive and it's very vague.
As we wrap up here, I mean, one of the things that I worry about with watching this go on is what how this could play into the National Defense Authorization Act that literally allows people to be taken up and held in this country, to be acted upon. But and these kind of the synergy of these things is frightening. I think America needs to know about them so we can stand up and start not letting the Muslims be carted away before there's no one else to be left to be carted away.
Oh, there's definitely some very serious civil liberties implications that I think we all need to take very seriously.
Sahara Aziz, it's been a pleasure to meet you, at least by phone and by on the air here, and we look forward to talking to you again. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to have all this stuff up on our website. Sahara Aziz's articles, the article by Chris Hedges and Andrew March. This is really something that I think that is chilling and we need to kind of stay on top of and recognize what could be going on in our midst, because we don't want that to happen to us. Not in this country. We're going to keep it free for all of us, I hope. I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Urbanite Magazine. This weekend, Urbanite's Healthy Film Food Series, part of the 2012 Urbanite Project, begins this weekend. This Saturday, April 28th, What's on Your Plate is being screened at the Y at Central Maryland on 33rd Street at 1 p.m. The movie follows two 11-year-olds as they try to find out where their food comes from. A very good film. The second movie, Urban Roots, covers the growing urban farming movement in Detroit, another great film. They'll be screened at the 2640 space on Friday, May 4th at 6 p.m., and you can find out more about the project online at urbaniteproject.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Aronson and Justin Levy. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our interns are Alexis Smith, Alex Pearson, and Tiffany Means. We're engineered by Regis Tucker. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cut. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and get information about our guests and the work they do, please join us over at steinershow.org. And coming up next here on WEAA, Wealthy Lifestyle with Deborah Owens. Her topic tonight will be discussing Holland Brothers, discussing teenpreneurs and women's philanthropy. And then after that, Guillermo Brown's here with Fiesta Musical. For Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.